Hello, I'm Claire Wright, Professor of Public Engagement at La Trobe University. Welcome to Literary La Trobe, a podcast showcasing the writing and research of La Trobe University's staff, students, adjuncts, and alumni. The recording you're about to hear was recorded and produced at La Trobe University on unceded Wurundjeri land. This episode is part of the English and Creative Writing podcast series. In 2024, acclaimed Australian writer and La Trobe University adjunct research fellow Christos Tsiokas was one of the judges of the Melbourne Prize for Literature. This prize is awarded to an essay demonstrating outstanding originality, literary merit, and creative freshness. The prize was won by Dr. Carrie Tiffany, lecturer in English and Creative Writing at La Trobe University, with Dr. Judith Bishop, Tracy Benevenu-Amar Fellow in the School of Humanities and Social Sciences at La Trobe University, picking up the Civic Choice Award. In this discussion, Christos, Judith and Carrie discuss the essay form. Can the essay be fresh? What makes a great essay? And why do they write them? They discuss Carrie's essay, Seven Snakes, published in Mianjin, Judith's essay, History Repeats, A Tale of Artificial Noses, published on the Melbourne Prize website, and Christos's most recent essay, Politics is Not Religion, published in The Monthly. I hope you enjoy.
Hello, everyone. It's a real pleasure to be here today with these two very special people. My name is Christos Tsiokas. I'm a writer and also adjunct research fellow at the Trobe University, which is something I never thought I'd say about myself when I was coming here to help out in the Rabelais office and also to watch bands back in a long, long, long time ago. We are here to talk about the art of essay writing. I was very, very fortunate to be a judge 2 years ago. Was it 2 years ago now, my friends? 1 year ago. For the Melbourne Prize for Literature. And there was, as part of the prize, an essay writing competition that Carrie Tiffany over here has won. And I'm going to get Carrie and you, Judith, to introduce yourself in a moment for a wonderful essay called Seven Snakes. Also, another wonderful essay was written by Judith Bishop, History Can Repeat, A Tale of Your Artificial Noses, which won the audience prize, I'm going to call it. They are both fascinating, beautifully written works about communication, about important things. We'll get into that as we have the conversation. But before we begin, why don't you do an introduction?
Oh, thank you, Christos. Can I just say we're delighted to have you at La Trobe as well. So I'm Carrie Tiffany. I teach in the English and Creative Writing program here at La Trobe. I'm teaching creative nonfiction and also writing fiction, which is a short story class. I'm a writer, but I'm a sort of late-to-life writer. I didn't start writing really till I was in my 40s. And before that, I had a more outdoor career. I was a park ranger and I've been working in the land care environmental movement for many years.
Yeah. And I'm Judith Bishop. I'm a Tracy Benevenu-Amar Research Fellow at La Trobe University. I also am newly back in academia. I spent almost 20 years in the language technology industry as a linguist, working with an enormous range of wonderful different languages. So now my interests include language and AI and the intersections of that, but I have always been a poet. Poetry is my first love. And so, yeah, I'm now coming into this area of exploring nonfiction and essay writing and really enjoying making that transition from poetry.
One of the things that I wanted to ask both of you is, what is it particularly about the nonfiction form that both draws you as writers and also that, because I love writing nonfiction, but I am very, very careful about it because it also terrifies me. There's something I feel like a freedom in prose, in fictional prose, that I can kind of escape. that doesn't feel as true for the nonfiction form. And I wonder if that's also true for you, Judith, as a poet, that there's a freedom there in terms of escape, or is that?
I think it's more a sense of responsibility, I suppose, to something that feels important to talk about in a different way from what I can say in poetry. So, yeah, for me, poetry has always been, I write lyric poetry, so it's always been very much about kind of, I don't know, perceiving the world, being in the world, what does it mean, how does it feel? Whereas, you know, the nonfiction is more about things that are happening in the world now, in technology, specifically AI, and what that might mean for us as we move into that future. So sort of taking some of those really those concerns that have always been there for me as a poet about how we relate to the world and how we relate to language and each other, and asking questions about what it means now that we are moving into an age of AI and how that might affect our creative existence, our existence in a whole range of ways. And yeah, I guess this essay is one of those where I started to explore a bit of that territory.
Judith, I was really fascinated by your essay, which has also got this beautiful title, which includes the word nose, which I really love. I think when I think about writing and I think about it as an art form, it's taken me a long time to kind of admit that it is an art form, but it is an art form, isn't it? Yeah. It's the least sensual of art forms, isn't it? So, you know, if you're a dancer, you can do things with your body. If you're a musician, you have all this feeling through sound. You know, if you're a painter, you have colour and you have texture and sculpture and whatever. But what we have these bits of ink, ugly shapes on sort of iron bits of a tree, and yet all this, everything can come off it. And in your essay, you're reading while you're writing the essay. You're kind of reading while you're talking to us in the essay. So we experience what's happening in your body when you're reading. And then this other thing kind of happens in our body as we're reading. And you actually talk about that, the homeostasis, those homeostatics. Can you talk a bit more about that? That really kind of fascinated me, because when you describe what the essay is about, and I often say to my students, apparent subject, deeper subject, apparent subject, deeper subject, and we use terms like AI, we think of this being very technological, but somehow you manage to put these concepts kind of back in the body and back in one body and make extra meaning from that. It doesn't reduce the meaning, but it increases it somehow.
Yeah. That's just there's so much insight in what you've just said. That's just amazing. I think that kind of concern for the body and how we move through writing in the body, I think it's coming to all of us in our different writings. If I can say, that's something I really appreciate in the essays and the fiction that you've written as well, is that you are so, so deeply moving us through the world in your body and reporting on that and reacting to things that happen in the world in real time. And so we are seeing things through your eyes and we're seeing things through your body, as it were. And that kind of resonance is so important to me. And I think, in terms of this essay, that was absolutely what felt essential to me to be doing. I think language does, you know, I know from poetry, as the poem unfolds on the page, we're actually moving with it literally, you know, around the turns of the lines. We're moving with the poem, we're moving with the emotions. And so it's taking us on a transformative, hopefully, journey from, you know, the start of the poem to the end. And it's kind of like if we don't feel, I think, in some way different by the time we finish reading a piece, then, you know, when the, you know, has that actually done its job? So in terms of this essay, because technology is so, can feel so distant, it can feel so impersonal, and at the same time, I think particularly with AI, we're all feeling very visceral about what its effects might be and how we might be impacted by it, or the world, you know, that we love might be impacted by it. And so I think bringing that response to the fore and really putting that on the page, these are my responses as I'm reading AI research, I'm feeling these things, felt very important to me. And that was, I guess, yeah, what felt maybe most creatively risky about that essay was trying to do that juggle between research and, you know, this is what I'm feeling about it in this moment. Thank you. That's a wonderful question. Thank you.
Well, Sydney, I mean, One of the things that was a real surprise about the essay, Judith, is that it's about the sense of smell. I mean, the nose is in the title, because that is the one, I mean, what I mean by that is the that glorious surprise, which is you made me think of something I'd never thought of before, that AI is something that is also going to make smells. I hadn't, you know, that I thought that was something so animal, so human, so organic that I didn't need to worry about it in terms of this technology. And you've, and I think I wrote to you that I've been haunted by it since I read it. And that's the haunting, that there is something that I truly, I don't even know if this is religious or spirit, like what the language we have to name it, which is something that I want to keep to us as an animal species that I don't want to give over to the machine. And I'm not talking about it as a Luddite. I'm talking about it as something that I think is really important that we nourish. Your poet's eye returns us to the garden at the end of your essay. Yeah. And I think that that's so a release for me in reading it, because, you know, I was terrified, because your essay deals with some real terrors about what is the possibility of a surveillance age when they can colonise our very sensualities, our bodies.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, it is. I think it's also it's an aspect of AI that we're not so conscious of and familiar with, is that there are sensors which can detect smells, which can detect the way we move, which can interpret various things about our physical appearance and the way that we interact with each other and with our devices. And so I think there is this whole kind of animal existence part of our world which is now becoming visible and interpretable to AI, and I really want that to be to surface that so we can understand and try and, you know, if we, where we want to say, no, we don't want to go there, that we have the opportunity to do that at a point in time at which it's not ubiquitous, that there is that opportunity still to say, no, actually, you know, this matters to me. And I love that you picked up on that, going back into the garden. I mean, gardens for me are places, you know, they're places of smell, places of deep peacefulness. And I wanted that to have that difference between that experience of peace and being, you know, feeling alive and being in a place, and to set that against that sense of vigilance that surveillance gives us, and that really I think can be quite harmful for the way that we feel in the world. So yeah, thank you for those.
And I was thinking, Kerry, actually, that's that notion of the garden. We were talking before, you know, I've got a phobia about snakes, and your wonderful essay, which is also playing with form, that was one of the surprises for me. Like, I remember actually saying that as part of the judge's table, kind of just that it surprised me, you know. And it was absolutely serious about what it is that we owe this other species, what we owe to this land we're on. You are writing fully aware and conscious of what that history is. But you are also being so playful in the form. So I want to ask you, was that kind of integral to you finding your way into this essay? But without forgetting the garden thing, it's the snake representing something really fearful in art. Histories, you know, particularly in the Christian tradition, right? Which is that it's the very symbol of evil, right? And what you do is you bring a sense of facing this animal that is meant to terrify us, and you really look at it. And I think that's the great gift of your essay. I really mean that. But please talk about how you found your way into that essay, because it's so playful as well as being so deadly serious.
Okay. Well, the essay is about some experiences that I had many, many years ago in my youth when I worked as a park ranger in Central Australia. And one of my tasks was I did have to catch snakes, and I was unfortunately bitten by a snake, a very venomous snake. But I also had other experiences with snakes just seeing them in the landscape, doing surveys on them. We kept a couple of snakes for demonstration purposes, a couple of pythons that we would sort of demonstrate with tourists. At one point I also had to, I lived with a snake for a while because an injured snake was brought to me to rehabilitate, and I sort of took it back to the caravan where I was living and I lived with it. I think I had some difficult times in the Northern Territory. So when I joined the ranger service, I think there were 99 rangers and there were three women, and they never stationed us together. And I was very young, and I think when I first started at Uluru, there were probably maybe 15 rangers working there. And there was quite a bit of sort of resentment about my employment. I think I'd mainly been taken on to work with the Anangu women, and we sort of built some bush tucker trails and did things together. But it was sort of felt I was in the wrong place. And I've sort of always felt I'm in the wrong place here. I am in the wrong place. I wasn't born here. I came when I was 7. And I think there was also something about coming when you're 7, when you have language and you spend the first few years of your life just comparing something to something else. You know, it's not like this, it's like that, you know. We were given that colouring book. we were sort of assisted migration when we came across. And I remember in the colouring book, I had to colour in the gum tree. And I thought it would be pink because it's the gums in your mouth. I thought it would be pink. And in fact, then I went to Central Australia and they are pink. Yeah. So
you were right.
I was right. But I remember the first time I saw, we went to Perth, the first time I saw a black swan. And I thought it was some hellish, I thought the government had painted them probably. It was astonishing to me. Everything was astonishing. But, you know, your eye closes, doesn't it? And you start taking everything for granted. And this is one of the things that I think we can do in writing somehow, is sort of retrieve some of those points in our lives when our eyes are very open and we can see things. So I've never written fiction about my time in Central Australia, and I don't think I ever will. I think I don't want to make story from it because it's not my place to make story from. And sometimes I think those decisions you make about what not to write about are as important as the ones you make about what to write about. So I don't want to write a story about some young female ranger in Central Australia. There are other much more important stories than that that come from that country that are not my story. But I'm very much interested in instinct. I think I'm very interested in kind of masculinity as well. I've always spent a lot of time kind of watching it and kind of being intrigued by what this thing is. And I've, you know, kind of sort of tried to live as a man in some ways, very unsuccessfully, but in some parts of my life it seemed like a better thing to do. I've given that up now. But
wish I could carry.
Yeah, interesting, isn't that? Although we had a sort of staff meeting yesterday, and the cupboard fell off the kitchen, and someone just brought it to me. Carrie can fix this. Yeah, I'm not sure I'm answering your question. Where did the playfulness come from? Where did the essay come from?
Do you mind me jumping?
No, please.
Because
do.
There is something about that that handy person thing you just referred to that I love, that I actually read in your essay, and to explain to people listening that what Kerry does in Seven Snakes is also illustrated with these very iconic images that I remember from children's books growing up. They're not Enid Blyton, but they're that kind of era of boys' own and girls' own adventures, with the snake figuring in the drawings or in the images that you use. And so there is something about the essay you're writing which is about an expert knowledge of how to do things that I really like, a how to, you know, there's something about being the ranger.
Okay, I didn't realise that.
And I think in juxtaposing those images with the words you use is that central moment for me of you taking the snake that this man from country gives you that has been hurt, and you take it into the caravan that you're living in, and you live with it for this period while it heals, and you live with it not pretending that it is a family member, or even, I can't remember off the top of my head the words you use, but there is a kind of a knowledge that we get as readers that this is a person who's taking on this task because of responsibility and doing it as well as they can. And I love that about the essay. Was that something of the experience you wanted us to understand in relationship to you and that animal?
Yeah, I think I'm working with symbols here, aren't I? So the symbol of the snake, and here I have the snake that I draw over the top of the learning with mother alphabet, you know, reader, the children's reader, which then from the time I grew up, they're about from the period I grew up, were appalling. The images in them were shocking, you know. Jane goes to the shops and, you know, Bill fixes the car. And so I'm sort of I'm doing something playful with that. I'm saying, well, hang on, the future. This is the future, you know. Welcome to this Freudian symbol, and what it might mean. And I don't want to do that too obviously in writing. So having those kind of those images throughout, I thought we're doing something else in the piece that I didn't have to do in a really kind of over the top kind of way in writing. So I'm saying something about desire, I think, at the heart of it, and instinct, and about being sort of out of place as well. And here's this creature that's in place. It's utterly in place, and I get to live with it a while, so it comes into my place, and I can observe it. But at the end, I see it acting, you know, we let it go. It's a beautiful moment. It's a very hard thing to write about because it was very joyful, but it just slithers off, you know, like initially kind of slowly in surprise, and then whoosh, it just kind of runs forward into its life and into this kind of bright light and whatever. It's very beautiful. I don't think I'll ever forget that. And yet in my life, where is my instinct? You know, where do I get to kind of run towards my desire like that? There is so much constraint, and there's so much history, and there's so much kind of struggle and difficulty, you know, those to be able to see that purity in this other creature. I'm a creature too, is astonishing, but it does make you kind of interrogate your own creatureliness and how you might kind of be within that. So yeah
I mean, just you speaking of that made me realize something that's always been a real question for me about being a white writer on this land and being from an immigrant background, in which it is like kind of what so many of our stories until quite recently have been fear and terror of this land, mm-hmm. or of the wildlife, of the, you know, which I think speaks to a whole ugly history that we find really difficult to deal with. And what I loved about the essay, Kerry, is when you were, even now when you were talking about it, is that I think you were able to weave those illustrations and what you do with the illustrations. Yes, it is about desire, but it's also about that history, right? Mm. That you're writing, and you're not hitting us over the head with it. Mm. You're actually, I think, doing something much more gentle, but equally important.
Yeah. How do you just see something without bringing that freight of mythology? How do you see something purely in its place when you don't have the language that surrounds it? You know, I know it's called Uluru, but that's not my language. No. I didn't really understand that.
But I think there is something about the looking. When I use that, I mean, it just came to me, you know, that this is the serpent and looking at it. And we were talking before, you know, I grew up with a fear of the snake. And it was, you know, I won't go into it, but just saying this is ridiculous. With trying to understand this animal, I will never be that animal. I'm not going to, you know, pretend that I can do that, live in its consciousness. But I want to be able to look without that terror. And that's what you do. I think that's something really important about the responsibility of writing that you talked about before, Judith, that, and what is constructive about constructive is the wrong word, but take that away, Chalkers. That's not the right word. What is, I think, important about the essay form and nonfiction is that it is a way of looking responsibly, whether it's something intimate to do with our past or something to do with our country or something to do with our history or something to do with our relationship with animals or our relationship with technology, and that ability to look at it seriously is, for me, what is the great power of a great essay, but also the great terror of writing in the nonfiction form. You know,
Christos, I think this is a point where we also talk about your essay. I think it's your most recent essay, which came out in the monthly, in the sort of Christmas issue, summer issue, which is an astonishing essay. And I really was, I've read it a number of times and I've sent it to a lot of people and I've said, please read that, because there are times when you feel something and you become nervous about saying it and someone else says it and says it so eloquently it sort of sings for you. And also mainly you just feel less alone in the world, which is a very good thing. So but you should say a little bit about it and tell us a little bit about it.
I was so scared of writing this essay. So to explain it is, it really is about me trying to make sense of what has become one of the most central questions of the moment in our age, which is the what is happening in Palestine, what is happening in Israel, on what, you know, this. It came from, this is the, I have been living in Preston, just down the road from this university, for 25 years. And it's always been this place that I've loved because it's just, we're from everywhere and that. And then but the tram stop that I've gone to for every day for 25 years, I walked down the street and it had this most horrible, vicious, racist graffiti, kill all Jews, you know, Jewish dogs die. It was so confronting. And thinking about how do you write something that says, I hold the horror that is happening in Gaza, as you know, I don't want to look away from that, but I also don't want to look away at an ugliness that is a form of racism called anti-Semitism that has been there all my life, and that I hate how our politics has become this. It's almost like the Hunger Games, right? That there's like a side that you barrack for, and a complexity of an issue that is just full of human suffering and pain that goes before what happened in October 2 years ago. And it's been going on for a long time, but that is to try and make a hierarchy of pain and to try and make a hierarchy of suffering is something that I really wanted to write about. So I think that's a really dangerous thing we're doing. I just wanted to say, I have friends who come from both places, Palestine and Israel. I have friends who, I just want to do justice to all those experiences, and I do not want to be asked to choose my friends about my, you know, that I can see. I think that's, I was terrified about writing this essay, but also I'm really glad I did it because I do want to, it was part of saying that thing we were talking about, just to go, can we really seriously look at each other?
It maintains, I think one of the things that essay can do, isn't it? It can be a kind of interrogation with yourself in which there can be contradiction. It can be open to contradiction in an essay. Someone might not know something and been trying to kind of work it out. But I also love, because Judith uses books in hers. Like, I think there are three books that you're kind of interrogating, or you're reading Stars of Land, you're reading Actors book as well. And we're sort of experiencing you reading those texts. Yes. But in yours, you use the film, the Godard film, and you repeat this lovely thing, sort of reverse shot, which you then repeat at the end. So it's got these really kind of lovely visuals that you manage to bring in through using the film. And that kind of interested me about there's the text itself, and then there's this other kind of text, this other act that's being brought forward.
Look, I was just going to say about the Godard film. It's called Notre Dame Music, and Godard's a filmmaker I've loved for a long time, and then, you know, some of his later period films are so esoteric that it's impossible to. It's not impossible. It's just you know, it's a bit like I do like your old stuff better than your new stuff. Except then I saw Notre Music, and it came. He actually filmed at the time of the civil wars in Yugoslavia, and there is, and he's taking a masterclass in film in Sarajevo, which is being bombed, and he shows a photograph of these Jewish refugees from Europe who have just escaped one of the most horrific moments in all of human history, the Holocaust. And he says, shot. That's what cinema can do. This is the image. And then the reverse shot is the Palestinians who have to flee their land because of the creation of Israel. And him doing it in the context of what was happening in Yugoslavia at the time is to say, anyone who thinks this history is simple, anyone who thinks this history can be
without
contradiction, that thinks that history is just a matter of good people who wear white hats and bad people who wear black hats, or the reverse, is actually someone who is failing the obligation of history. And that's, I think, so sorry, Judith, I will shut up just to say that there is something great about being able to build our arguments from people who have gone before, like, isn't it?
Yeah. What I really loved was the way that you're actually, like, you're moving through the world. You see this sign, you see this graffiti, you're responding to it, and then you're just unfurling this whole, in a thoughtful reflection on it, and you're responding to things in real time. There's a woman who is also responding to that graffiti, and you're feeling, you know, her reaction. And so it's just that, as you're going, you're questioning, you're, you know, there is this dialogue with yourself, and then, yeah, and then the Godard comes in, and it's like, it just kind of encapsulates that in a little metaphor, in like both sides. You can't have one without the other. There's a shot, there's reverse shot. And so that kind of just is a guiding kind of image that continues through. But I love the way that you, in your writing, are just, you know, again, I think we spoke about it before, we're in your body reacting to and feeling things as you feel them in real time. And I think that's just that complexity in that movement and that response to the world is what I just find incredibly powerful. I think that's, you know, for me, really encapsulates just the, you know, the living conscience that you have in that essay.
It's a great term, that living conscience, because, you know, my friends, it's that thing before you were talking about that really moved me, Kerry, about writing. Like, I mean, writing does have a physical manifestation. Like, we all know it. Like, you know, as we're leaning over in the desk or the notebook or the computer, you know, there's things that happen. But sometimes I think, I wish I was a musician. I wish I was a playing player. Jansen, that you could do something so abstract that touches the beautiful or the sublime or the, or whatever it is that is the transcendent. That's, you know, I shouldn't be scared of that word. But with writing, we're locked into consciousness, right? We're locked into language in a particular way. And it sounds like we're all struggling to find, how do we deal with that responsibility?
But sometimes you reach out to other arts, like you do with the film there, and you do with your visual arts. And so that's the way we kind of compromise and, you know, bring some of that into our own art through engaging with other arts.
I was just going to say, you know, because we're all, you know, we've got a relationship with something called the university. And I know when I speak to creative writing students, it's always like, read. Like, you know, how do you become a good writer? You read. But also you go to the cinema, you go to the gallery, you go to see plays. That's because all of that will inspire you. All of that will
feed you.
That's the word. Yeah. It's about the body again, right?
Yeah, these are artificial divisions between the arts, really, aren't they? They kind of do flow into and complement and enrich.
Can I ask you both what you like to read in terms of essays, like who you read and who you think is fantastic?
Oh, look, I think the first, you know, there's something about the age when you first encounter, you know, that when you're young, you know, I'm thinking of that adolescent period when you first encounter work and whatever the art form, I mean, there's something, because you're so naive. Mm-hmm. And so you're easily, you know, you're just like so excited. But I do remember reading Camus, the French writer, and I'd loved his fiction, but reading his nonfiction, The Fall, reading The Myth of Sisyphus, and going, okay, these are great, these are amazing ideas that are asking me to think in a different way. I think the other two that immediately come to mind, and it will change tomorrow if you ask me, right? You know that. But that I got given George Orwell's essays to, and that because of the lucidity of his, like, kind of the clarity and the straightforwardness of that man's writing, kind of it just, right, you know, reading Down and Out in Paris and London, I felt like I was there in those cities, though I didn't even know if I'd ever go there. And the other one was, I was really lucky that a friend's mother gave me Joan Didion, the White Album, and that...
Yeah, that's one of my absolute number one.
Because it was like, you can write about anything. You can write about what is happening in the culture, hate Icebury, but you can also write about your relationship to a piece of music or to friendship. She's an astonishing writer, Didion.
I read that essay in there about the reservoirs, the water, over and over again. It's utterly fascinating. Were you always reading nonfiction and fiction together?
I was much more, you know, fiction was the gateway drug to writing by far. But I think with nonfiction, I had to cultivate a patience in a way that felt different to fiction. I'm just looking at you, Judith.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, now I'm going right back. So I think the first essays that really struck me were by Roland Barthes when I was doing a period where I was immersed in French literature. So there's this book called The Rustle of Language and one particular essay called The Grain of the Voice, where he's really interrogating why the sound of a particular singer has such a kind of visceral, again, impact on him. Why does this do this for him? And it's a very, he understands a very individual response to this voice. But I'm just, and then it also has this longer book, Camera Lucida, about a photo of his mother and really, again, it's like this moment of her, I think, in Winter Garden, and why does that affect him in the way that it does? So these essays around moments of perception and what feeling they generate in the writer, I think those for me really, were very important. And then I went off into poetry for many, many years and am now coming back to essays. But those were some of the ones that I think are probably behind when I write nonfiction. There's those sort of voices that are kind of there somewhere in my head.
Do you think, does that kind of reading feed your poetry as well?
Possibly indirectly, I guess. I really did kind of deeply immerse myself in poetry and all different poets from different, different languages and backgrounds. And so that's been more my focus for many, many years. So I'm now reaching back, I think, as I say, to those earlier influences and, expanding my reading again beyond poetry.
Did you read nonfiction right from the get-go?
No. I felt unqualified to do so. I just was in my caravan reading novels, just reading enormous numbers of novels that I had sent down from the library in Alice Springs on these Greyhound buses. And down to the rock, I would get on the bus in my ranger uniform, and I think the tourists were all excited. They thought I was coming to, and I'd just pick up my big pile of books and leave. And I didn't, this was pre-catalogue. So I had this librarian who was choosing them for me, the books for me. And initially he sort of sent me these books like Ask the Leyland Brother. Because he knew I was a park ranger. But then he sent me Christina Stett. And he sent me Thea Astley's The Well-Dressed Explorer, I remember. And I just wrote back more like that, and so I was off really. So thanks to that librarian in Alice Springs. No, I've never contacted him. But he wrote to me once and said, I'm going on this librarian's tour of the UK and France. And then so he started sending me Thomas Hardy and he sent me Proust
I'm falling in love with him.
I've always been a bit in love.
I think we all need one.
Yeah, I'm sure he's very long retired and long dead now. But that was a kind of lovely pen pal experience that I had with him. He'd send me these books, which is very trusting of him too. But I, you know, I don't, you know, I hadn't been to university or anything. I didn't have an education. I left school at 16. And I just read a lot. And I certainly sort of nonfiction or essay, I would not have gone there. You know, I just wouldn't have felt that I, that it was for me or that I would have understood it. So it wasn't until much, much more recently than I started to read. And I actually, one of the first book of essays that I read was by Elliot Weinberger.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's called Karmic Traces. And it's, I just think it's incredible. And it really,
it
I thought,
incredible.
Oh, yes, you can do this, you know. You can, I thought you had to kind of elide yourself and you had to have a kind of academic voice and but he was this thread from fiction into the essay, into this creative nonfiction that I could follow, you know, and then I even got to meet him at a writer's festival, which was really very special. He's also got another political book that I think is really interesting. It's called What I Heard About Iraq, which is just a series of quotes that came out just after the Iraq War, which I think is very, very good. So he's very interested in form and kind of mucking around with form. And that sent me back into James Baldwin and all this kind of fantastic stuff. But now you're talking about it, I haven't actually read much Camus nonfiction. Maybe should I go there? Should I read Sisyphus? And
yeah, I actually returned to him over the COVID period. It was funny, I was going through some books and you know when you're younger, you kind of want that surety. And I was reading like Sartre, you know, being the head honcho existentialist. And I was reading his non-fiction and it's turgid as, right, because especially once he became a Marxist, it was like he was so blind to what Anna talks about in Stasiland, right? And whereas Camus was engaged, but he was always going, I am not going to take a position without thinking it through. So it's history. You look back at it going, and Camus is actually doing that thing of going, I will question everything, and I'm not going to pretend I have an answer. So reading him still feels fresh, whereas reading some of the older writers felt like so mired into a past. And I don't blame them. They just did. I do. There's something I do. Like, I don't think, I think there is genuine ignorance that is just ignorance, and I think there is sometimes willful ignorance, and that is not something admirable, whether we do it ourselves or someone else does it. But yeah, so yes, to Camus, I think he's a terrific writer. I was just thinking about my friend, the kind of, actually in terms of nonfiction, as I said, I felt like what you were saying, Kerry, that it took me a while to be able to read feel like I could understand it. Like I always felt like I was at the back of the school class and like not doing very well. But then what did give me a love for writing and thinking was reading film critics and music critics. I had that from really young. And so I talk a lot about Pauline Kael, the American film critic, because I read her and she, not that I agree with her, you know, I disagree about 50-50 with her evaluation of a film, but my God, she's a great writer and she makes you think. Yeah. And she writes, the best way I've used is she writes like jazz. It's free form. And the thing is, we all love good writing. Doesn't matter what the subject is, you have to be a good writer, whether you're writing fiction or poetry or nonfiction, to be able to respond to someone. And I think that those music and Graham Marcus, the music critic too, was a way of making me think more of the world around me, because he was like Kyle, they're talking about films and music and I grew up with films and music.
And there's that lovely movement, isn't there, of someone responding to something. So you can see them responding to something and
yes,
you're responding to them responding to them. It's kind of this wonderful, in a mirroring experience. I think, yeah, I love reading poetry reviews for the same reason and other arts reviews, because you're seeing it through someone else's eyes or body. And
I mean, Lina, now sometimes I just think with criticism, because I love criticism so much, just be better at it. Like, you know, just be better writers about it, you know, to take it seriously as a form, the way we've been talking about the essay.
As writing.
Yeah.
Well, I think we should probably finish, but let's, can I extract some tips from my students from you before we finish? Some pithy advice about the essay.
Gosh. Oh, well, I mean, I think the essay is what it says. It is trying something. And so you may not actually come in at the place where you end up starting. It really is just starting to write and seeing where the writing takes you. I mean, for me, writing is a process of listening. I'm just listening and seeing what comes. And then, you know, you can move the bits around and do whatever you want with it. But yeah, I think if you're not listening to what's coming from yourself, then you're probably missing something. So that's what I would say.
Lovely.
I would say, because I'm looking across to a poet, and I love poetry, and I'm so conscious I'm not a poet. So what I have done for years is by my bed, both on the bedside table, I always have a book of poetry. So I can go in and, because you kind of, if you're not a poet, to understand it, you have to read it. And I would say that to about the essay is go to an op shop and for $1.50, pick up a book of essays. Like it could be on anything, right? And it could be, you could do Joan Didion, you could do George Orwell, you could do, William Finnegan. I mean, but just actually pick it up and or go to the library even better and pick up and then read. And you will find what is the form that sings to you. And that's my only advice really that I would say is just read the essay.
Great. Well, I think my students have probably heard me saying this over and over again. And here I am getting to say it to them again, which is sort of slowly. Yes, that I think your listening is terrific advice, Judith. But, you know, don't push it. Just kind of wait for it to happen. Yeah. And sometimes it can take a long time for something to come together. So this essay is something that, you know, happened in my 20s, a lot of it, and yet I'm writing about it now and I'm thinking about it now. So it's always there. It's always kind of possible for you. So, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Do you have the... amount of words a day? Does that?
No. Oh, well, I try to when I'm working on a novel because then I can see sort of in the sight and it's nice. And I have lots of writer friends who really do it and I'm very admiring of them. But within a short period of time, I've broken it and then I'm very despondent and then I might try again. Yeah. But do you do it?
I do. But you're absolutely right. It's when you're working on a novel. Otherwise, but I was just thinking, you know, it is, I do keep a journal, which I've done for decades. And there is something about, I mean, you know, there'll be weeks when I'm not writing in it, but then, you know, it is exercise, right? This is how we, you know, you speak to any artist, you speak to a painter, you speak to a dancer, you speak to a singer, you know, they do their exercises. And that's what we, you know, that's how we stop ourselves getting out of shape, is doing the exercises. Sorry, that's much more
promising than we should finish on that note. Thank you, Christos. Thank you, Judith.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie. Thank you, Judith. This was an absolute...
You've been listening to Literary La Trobe, a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Jajawarong and Tuggerong country. You can find out more about this podcast and other La Trobe podcasts on the La Trobe University website.